Hello, Norm.
Hey, how are you?
Hello, everyone. I think everyone here is going to be in for a real treat today. Norm Farrar is one of the top podcasters for e-commerce and online selling. He has just started this session on Clubhouse about 2 weeks ago. I think this is the third time, Norm. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah, so I'm very much looking forward to hearing today. I actually have invested in a number of e-commerce companies, and I know Jeff has as well. So you've got some people here today who would be happy to talk more about how to sell online successfully. Norm, I'm going to pass it to you. You are the moderator. You are the king of this. Enjoy.
Very good. So if you could just pass me over so I could be the moderator. I see.
I can't talk and make people moderator at the same time. There you go.
You did a good job.
All right. Take it over.
All right. So welcome, everybody. We've got a room that's going to be concentrating on how to become a better online seller. And with that today, we're going to be talking about product information, or product innovation. And I've got an innovation specialist that's going to be joining us, Offalabi Orokan, who, when Amazon was starting to get into the FBA business, so Amazon, fulfilled by Amazon, the business that people know now, usually for private label, he was a consultant. So he knows his stuff. And I see you've been brought up. So, hey, Offalabi, how are you?
I'm good. And you?
I'm doing fine. So just give me one sec here. I've just got a couple messages that are popping up. I don't know how to get rid of them. But we also have Paul Barron, Michelle, how do I say your last name?
Van Tilborg.
That's it. I didn't want to mess it up. And no Jeff. Problem. And what we're going to talk about again is going to be brand innovation. I'm welcoming everybody to the room. If you get a chance, invite people. I think this is going to be something that's not readily talked about. And I can't wait to get going. So if you do have questions, just raise your hand and we will bring you up on the stage and just, you know, throughout the podcast or throughout the room. So first of all,
Norm, just before you go, I just want to remind everyone we are recording this session today. So everyone who is on stage now is giving their permission to be recorded. And should you be invited up on stage to ask a question or contribute something later on, by joining the stage, you will be acknowledging your permission for us to record this session. If you don't want to be recorded, please don't come on stage and speak.
I'm just going to give my auditory. Yes, this is Paul Barron. I consent.
All right. And I think that's good. All right. So let's just kind of go around the room and do a quick introduction. Jeff, can you just tell a little bit about yourself?
Sure, Norm. Thanks. And thanks for inviting me to join you today. It's a great topic and I look forward to it. I'm Jeffrey Sass. I'm a co-founder and CMO of Dot Club Domains. But in the e-commerce realm, I'm also the CMO of Paw.com. So we're a pet products company sold directly through a Shopify Plus store, as well as on Amazon and some other locations. So very excited to join the conversation. Thank you, Norm.
You're very welcome. Michelle, how about you?
Thank you for having me. I'm Michelle Van Tilborg. I am the CEO of Meowingtons.com. Meowingtons is the number one cat lover and cat toys and whatnot e-commerce website. That's an independent, let's just say, digital native brand. Also, I'm the president of Dot Club Domains, which we just sold to GoDaddy. So that's just high-level background. Thank you. Michelle speaking.
Okay, fantastic. And Paul?
Yeah, I had to get out of – I was inviting people. Paul Barron, I have been working for myself to one degree or another since, officially for the past 5 or 6 years. But started when I was a little kid selling drawings in grocery stores to grandmas. But the companies that I run now, co-own a co-founder of Bow & Bell Littles with my wife, Rochelle, who is the CEO. She is amazing at product innovation. And unfortunately, I don't know if she's available to join this call, but I could see if she can. I worked myself out of a job there, hired on a CMO to replace myself there. And now I run Chat Marketing University and the co-founded the chat agency actually with Norm earlier. Let's see, it was last year. And in the chat agency, we focus on running done for you chat marketing funnels and services for people. And we build out a lot of influencer groups and kind of raving fan bases for people leveraging conversational marketing. Do you want me to keep talking, Norm? I'm joking. But Awful Lobby, good to see you, man.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good, good, man. It's been a while. I think we've both been super busy, so I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
Same here. Thank you. So I'm Awful Lobby. I've been designing and developing products for 20 plus years. I have a background in product sourcing, development, design. I actually co-own Honu Worldwide with Norm. We do product sourcing. We do freight. We do import, export. We have a 3PL center here for order fulfillment and forwarding to Amazon. We support a lot of 7-8-figure sellers, multi-channel order fulfillment, multi-channel order concierge, management. So I'm happy to be here, with everybody. Thank you.
Okay, so I had no idea I had my mic off. We are doing a bit of a different format. I explained this last week where either from my podcast or people that I know, we're going to be bringing on different topics each week and having specialists that come on. Typically, I'm hoping from either my Monday, Wednesday, or Friday podcast that will join us on the Thursday night or the Thursday 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time room. And today, what we're doing is talking with Awful Lobby Eurocon. Awful Lobby contacted me, and this is kind of cool. He contacted me, said he was a sourcing agent, and I kind of rolled my eyes. I've heard a million sourcing agents, and then he told me a bit about his background and what he can do and what I'm not doing correct, and said I got to partner with the guy. So Awful Lobby is full of knowledge. Today's topic is going to be about product innovation. There's a lot of talk going around Amazon right now, talking about. And this is for e-com in general, too. If you're selling what everybody else is selling, you can get sales by being the better listing or being more aggressive in external marketing. But to get around that, leveraging and becoming slightly different than anybody else will give you that heads up. And I've got like Michelle, Jeffrey, and Paul and Awful Lobby are all experts in this, and they've all taken their products to a whole different level. So I thought that's why we would bring them on stage. So let's start off, Awful Lobby, with product innovation. Tell me a little bit about it. Tell me a bit about the costs and, you know, what people can expect. Because a few people, there's probably a lot of new listeners here who have no idea what we're talking about. And you're muted.
Thank you, Norm. So again, I'm happy to be here talking about product innovation. We can all see that selling online has changed drastically for the past 2 years. If you are new to selling online and you just want to launch a new product, I would really, really advise you to not really get into it unless you have a unique selling advantage above your competitors. Right now, we see factories, Chinese factories, just knocking product off, everywhere and selling for cheap. It's almost race to the bottom for every product now. I mean, if you go on Amazon and just type in any product that you want to buy, you see so many brands that you can't even pronounce the names. You don't know even know what they mean. And they're outselling you because they are the factory. So, for example, you're getting a product for like $2 from the factory and you want to sell it for $10. And but the factory is competing with you and they can sell it for $5. They don't care if they make 50 cents. You care if you make you have to make $2-3 in profit. They don't care about $3 in profit. They're okay with 50 cents or 25 cents in profit because they want to move volume. So a lot of factories in China have wised up to the opportunity that they can sell direct to consumers rather than selling to you and I, the entrepreneurs. So now the table has turned. We have to be innovative. We have to come up with products that you can easily protect it by patents or trademarks or copyright, something that would prevent anybody from just knocking you off and just, you know, releasing fake items and just, you know, diluting the market for you. And to innovate a product and to do a variation or a better variation of a product is really not that expensive as many people think. So many people get turned off that, oh my God, I'm going to spend like $80,000, $100,000 on this product idea that I have. Well, I mean, you know, we've done so many products, innovative products for 5,000, you know, sometimes, you know, less than 10 grand to innovate a really, really cool product. And you go ahead and secure it with a Chinese patent. Not only should you go into the U.S. patent, I think you should take your fight even to China and just patent it in China as well, so that you know nobody can export that product out of China without your consent. So this is where I think we should start, Norm, honestly, because with the COVID situation and everything going on around here, product longevity in Amazon before used to be 2-3 years. When you release a new product, you could enjoy your sale, you could enjoy your dominance for 3 years, you know, sometimes 4 years. But now an average lifespan of a product is probably 2-3 months. In 3 months, someone has copied you. They've copied you, they've come up with a cheaper version, and if you're selling it 50% less than your price. So what are you going to do? You can't even rely on all these products to, you know, if this is your full-time, you know, business, full-time, you know, money generator, you cannot even sleep well knowing that somebody could come up, you know, in a week or two or a month down the road and just knock everything out and just price you all the way low. And you're not competitive because you're not the factory. You still have to manufacture from the factory. So I think being innovative, no matter how small your innovation is, it's the key right now to staying on top of the game and, you know, gaining your dominance.
So just before we move it on to the panel, I wish this was visual, because I have, as you can see by my image, I have a beard. I bought a beard comb. And what I did recently, about a year ago, I did a quick where I bought a sandalwood comb and it cost me 79 cents. I don't know how anybody sells anything for 79 cents on Amazon, at least, but this could be any e-commerce platform. You have a plain old sandalwood comb that came cello wrapped. It was 79 cents. The next one that I bought was in a nicer package, and it had a vinyl sleeve. So product innovation was fairly simple. It was a vinyl sleeve and a nice package. That went up from 79 cents, same manufacturer, to $11.95, I believe. And then the other one that I bought, so now I have three beard combs, which I don't know what to do with, but the other one came in a leather sleeve with a slit. That was it. It was just a die that cut a slit for your credit cards, and that was $17.95. Mm-hmm. Checked back before we got onto this call, and there is the same beard comb going for $30 on Amazon right now. I don't know how good the sales are, but the other thing is, for product innovation, It could be the way it's imprinted, packaged, and delivered. I mean, it's really that simple.
Is this all the same company, Norm?
Yeah, completely. It's the same manufacturer. And all the person said was probably, I have no idea, but I know what I would say is there is an opportunity on Amazon to back to the supplier. Is there anything that you can do? What are your suggestions? Or going over to a company that does product innovation and saying, hey, what can you come up with that will make us stand out from the crowd? But all three, these are 100% the same company.
You know, it's this conversation for me is hard to have without talking about the importance of branding, because oftentimes the brand itself is the differentiating factor. And literally you sell, you know, similar form factor. I mean, look at Yeti. You know, they have these, well, there's a lot of different products that they have, but they have these koozies that are just soda can, you know, beer can koozies, that now there's a whole bunch of other companies that sell similar things to Yeti, but Yeti itself has built such a name for themselves that chances are that, I mean, if I'm going to buy something in that category, it's going to be from Yeti because of the name, because I trust the name. And I know that they have good, you know, they got a good warranty policy. They got a good return policy. Their products themselves are solid. So without derailing the conversation, like how much do you want to spend time talking about even like branding is can branding itself be innovative? Can you leverage just the power of packaging? Because it sounded like this with this beard comb, it wasn't really like so much product innovation, more like depth to the brand, like more supplemental type things.
Yeah, Paul,
I agree that with that beard comb, how much can you do with the beard comb? Put a handle on it, make it look a little different, put it two-sided. So if I take a look at that extension, that packaging, well, there was an outer package and it looked fantastic. And each price point was a much higher package, quality and package. Matter of fact, the 17.5 or $17.95 package actually had a magnetic clasp to open it up, which was kind of cool. But the product itself, this is product innovation, because now I can carry my credit cards. And that was always a hassle. So it is, in this case, it is packaging, but it is an extension of the comb. So I thought that was kind of cool. But I wanted to talk to Jeff, because I love Paw. I love Paw.com. And, you know, you always are coming up with really cool, innovative products. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely, Norm. But I first wanted to comment on some of the stuff that you and Paul have been saying, because it's kind of interesting, because we're talking about, as Paul pointed out with the branding point, we're talking about a lot of different types of innovation. Sometimes it's the product itself where it's something that could potentially be patentable. But sometimes, as you were pointing out, Norm, it's really just how you're presenting your product, how you're differentiating yourself to stand out and give the perception of quality over and above some of the competition. And in many of those cases, while it may not be patentable, what it can do is it can increase your profit margins dramatically. As you pointed out with the example of adding a simple case to the comb, you are actually charging more than the original comb itself without anything. And so your margins went up in that case dramatically, dramatically more. So I think there's lots of levels to the difference between innovation and differentiation. And both are very important in today's market. You need to stand out. And then you also want to protect yourself as much as possible with patentable innovations. At Paw.com, you know, we definitely are always looking to make, you know, a better mousetrap, or in this case, a better dog bed or cat bed or pet blanket, by innovating on things, even our own designs. And I'll give a great example. Recently, we introduced a new product called the Pup Cloud. And the Pup Cloud is a shredded memory foam bed that's 7 inches thick, really fluffy and comfortable. Think of it almost like a bean bag with memory foam inside for your pet. And we have Marley, who's the dog of the CEO and founder of the company, David Gimmis. And she's also on our payroll as our chief product tester. And when we got our first sample in from the manufacturer, we noticed that when Marley, you know, plopped down on the bed, like on a beanbag, she kind of just sunk right down into the middle, and almost the foam was touching, you know, touching her butt to the floor. So it wasn't as cushiony as it could be. So with that, David, who's really our chief product designer, came up with a very innovative and very simple way to create compartments inside the foam liner so that the foam, instead of being one big bag of foam, there were three compartments for the foam. Almost, when you think about it, like in a raft that has several air compartments or an air mattress. And that way, when the dog sits on it, they don't sink to the bottom, and it creates a much more cushioned, much more comfortable bed for the dog. And we have a patent pending on that design. And it was something that was actually, from a cost perspective, very simple to do it. It required more stitching inside the lining. It's not like you had to go back and design new molds or spend thousands of dollars to retrofit something to create that innovation. So as an example of that, that's an example of how sometimes just some simple adjustments, a few stitches here and there, or just looking at something with different eyes and thinking about it differently can lead you to a great product information, product innovation that will help you differentiate in the marketplace. I'm Jeffrey and I'm done.
I just wanted to comment on that, like, because you touched on something that Alpha Lobby had said, that oftentimes people don't even think about innovating because they assume that it's going to be cost prohibitive. Or I would also argue from experience that you just don't know what to do. Like, you don't know what steps to take. You had mentioned that you have a, you know, a product designer. How would you go about, let's say, if you're the average entrepreneur starting out solo, what, you know, what steps would you take, Jeff, for our audience that if, you know, you don't have resources to even begin to know where to even look for a product designer, what would you do?
Well, and I would say that we don't have like a trained product designer. We have someone who founded this company who's got a really sharp product sense, and also who listens very carefully. So one of the things, you don't have to be a designer per se to listen to feedback from your customers or testers. So, you know, if you have an idea for a product and you have a prototype, you know, don't assume that that's the way you're going to finish the product. Take that prototype, get it in front of people who you think will be your likely customers, get it in front of everyone on your team, get it in front of family members, get feedback and listen to that feedback. You know, the problem when someone has an idea, and this, in my opinion, is true, not just for products, but anytime, we consider our ideas very precious because they're our ideas. So when we have an idea, it's oftentimes very hard to really listen to someone's comments because we perceive it as criticism, and it's often not criticism. It's often honest feedback. So you have to get yourself out of that mindset. Well, this was my idea and it's great, to this was my idea. How can I make it better by listening to that feedback? So you don't have to be a designer to listen to customer feedback, to do some testing, to do focus groups with a prototype and really understand how you can improve upon your product, I think.
I love that. And I want to say, just for everybody listening too, if you just joined or you didn't have an opportunity to write down what Jeff said, we have access to the recording. How do we get access to the recording? Well, click up, you see up above Colin's head, there's a little club icon, it's a little greenhouse. Tap on that, and then you can click join that club. And there's info on there, startup.club. You can go to that site and then you get access to all the recordings there. So I just wanted to point that out, because what Jeff said may sound on the surface like, oh, that makes sense. But what you mentioned, something is really important. You didn't call it confirmation bias, but that's what it is, that we have inherently as humans, we want our ideas to win, even when they're crap ideas or they're being executed better by somebody else. And so I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs, especially getting started, that they're just so in love with their version of the idea because it's their baby, that they don't really take that constructive criticism, whether it's from a coach, a mentor, or more importantly, from like you had said, going to your customers and asking them, I feel like that's something that I could do better. And I've been doing this for, I feel like, a decently long time, and it's a natural pitfall that people can fall into. So Norm really quickly asked me to reset the room. So like I said, make sure you're following the club. You get access to the recordings as well as the people here on stage. You definitely want to look at the bios, Colin, Norm, Jeff, Michelle, myself, Avalabi, Rana, and give us a follow, because how Clubhouse works, if you're new to Clubhouse, you're not going to be able to see when, you know, these smart people are speaking unless you follow them. So there's a quick room reset again. This is recorded, so if you're coming up on stage and you're going to speak, we ask that you just give consent. And so back over to you, Norm.
Yeah, one of the things that you can do, if you don't have that network, if you can't get that feedback instantly or just, you know, talk to your partner or whoever about your product, one other way of getting very quick feedback is either going to a company like Usability Hub, asking the question, show your product and ask, you know, ask their focus group how or what you can do to improve it. And you can do it's PicFu as well is another company that you can go out and grab an audience, an instant focus group around your demographic and ask them about the product and you'll get some instant feedback. It costs a little bit of money, but it's very inexpensive for the feedback that you'll get. So Edmund, welcome to the stage. You have a question.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Hope you're having a great afternoon.
And could you just confirm, Edmund, sorry, that you agree to be recorded?
Oh yes, I agree. But I promise you I'm not a Democrat. So I run a startup company. We're an incubator. We own 1,000 domain names. We work with other domainers. We help build out their portfolio and create real businesses and do the heavy lifting, which is essentially all the shipping. We outsource all of our development and software in Chandigarh, India, and in Jaipur. And you can see in my profile that I was with DMX when he was here in Chicago. He just recently passed away. So I just want to give everybody my blessings and say I love you. Health, wealth, love. Bless up.
Did you have a question?
Hey, I actually have a question. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Colin.
I know we were talking about patents, and I think that there is a little bit of a trick. Now, I understand I'm not a patent lawyer. Okay. But and early on, with some of the e-commerce companies that I've invested in, they did not file for patents before the product launched. However, in the United States, if you launch the product, you have up to a year to file that patent. It will only give you protection in the United States. If you want global protection, you need to do it. You need to file patents prior to the launch of the product. I'd like to hear a little bit more about China and understand how to actually file patents in China, if Avalabi could expand on that. But one trick to save money as a startup is to get your product launched, even if it's just a Shopify site, you put it up there so nobody else can technically take it away from you if you succeed at applying for a patent within a year and you gain that patent. Calling out.
Yes, Colin, the patenting in China is very similar to the US. In fact, you could use, if you've already filed your patent in the US, you could use the script of the patent and just have a lawyer in China do the Chinese filing. They do have the design patent, the utility patent. It's very similar. It's only in the translation and how things are going to be explained. So when we're filing patents in China, the laws are just a little different from the US, but I think it's the description, like we have two lawyers in China that helps us do all these things. It's the description, how you describe it in such a way that the examiner will not shut it down when it's going through the process with the Chinese authority. Another thing they do well in China, you know, that I just learned from my lawyer is not only do you patent in China, you can actually register with the Chinese customs after you file your patent so that if they come across anybody trying to export your product, they can actually seize the goods before it leaves China.
All right, you know, Bobby.
I have a question, a follow-up question for that. Is it okay, Norm?
Yeah, go ahead.
So with patents and stuff, like, you know, registering patents, you just walked us through that. Is there a similar process for trademarks and like business names? And is that important? And if so, like, what steps do you do?
Yes, it's very similar. Trademark is, we do a search. The lawyer does the search. And so in with trademarks in China, it's more of first to file, not first to use. In the US, it's let me make sure I'm not mixing that up. In the US, it's first to use. In China, it's first to file. So even if you own a you own a brand name and somebody else files in China before you, they typically own that name unless you really want to put on your boxing gloves to fight. It's a very weird thing, but it's, you know, you do a search in China, the lawyer comes up with, comes back to you with a series of similar looking marks or names, and then he advises you on your chances of being approved. And it's like, you know, it's like a $750 kind of package, but it gives you peace of mind, and it's very, you know, I think it's very simple to do.
Thanks, Alpha Lobby. So we do have three people going to be asking questions, but I want to get over to Michelle. Michelle has a company called Meowingtons, as she mentioned at the beginning. And again, just really great, innovative products. I wanted to just talk to Michelle a little bit about her product line.
Sure. Thank you, Norm. So getting back to what the topic was, as I understood, was about innovation and product design. So for us at Meowingtons, our philosophy has been driven by what we see that our customers want. And fortunately for us, our team is very passionate about cats. And we, you know, we mirror the demographic in many ways. So our team is very interactive, all of us together, thinking and designing the products that we hope to bring to market. One thing I would point out for us that we find really important, because especially now, like shipping and lead times are so long, shipping costs are through the roof. They're oftentimes triple what they were post-pandemic. We've had to be even more careful and cautious about what we produce, right? You could just run yourself right into the ground very quickly. What we really try to do is make sure that we're looking at prototypes and working very closely. Mostly we're doing this with China, with the factories. We also, because some of our products are on the higher price point spectrum compared to your average cat items, is we try to do tests. So we try to, even though it might mean that we don't make money on the first generation of a product, that's okay because we consider that to be a valuable information and data. So we try to order the minimum that we can, making sure that we have enough profit margin to obviously ship it to us, but also be able to digitally advertise it. So that's something for us that's really critical. Let's just say to the formula is really thinking about how much it's going to cost to advertise. For us, we do almost 100% Facebook and Instagram ads. So we need to test the product not only for its demand and its reception in the market, but also for what kind of ad spend we're required. We build this into the cost. We take the landed cost, which means the cost to actually get the product into your warehouse. Then we actually factor in what is the, you know, average cost to sell, so the cost of the acquisition. And then if it's a higher price point, which means we probably ship it to the customers for free, we include that. So you can see very quickly, if you don't have a good understanding of these metrics, which is hard to do unless you can sell, you could run yourself into the ground really quickly and unexpectedly. So for our recommendation, what we recommend is, yeah, obviously, like, work really hard to try to innovate. Innovation for us also doesn't mean that we're, like, for lack of a better term, trying to build a better mousetrap, but we're really, like, looking at the market and the products that people like, that we know they like and that we like, and trying to make them better quality, because that's a void in the marketplace for cat items. And we're also always trying to look at how we can also make them aesthetically pleasing, which has traditionally not been the case for a lot of cat items. So I know I've said a lot here, but, you know, at the bottom of this, I would say, yes, product design is really important, and it helps distinguish your brand and move you forward. I would suggest to people, you know, before you run or, you know, take on other people's money, like, really think about what are all the costs to be profitable for that product. And I really believe the best way to do that is to try to do small orders, working very closely with whatever factory that you trust, and then come to market and test it and see where you can, you know, squeeze out profitability and refine. That's Michelle done speaking. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm curious off lobby what you'll say about this. I've got just a follow-up question with Michelle, what Michelle was talking about. I know this is going to be, you're going to come back and say, how long is a piece of string? But costs associated with innovation. Can you kind of go through that?
Yes, sure. So there are different kinds of products that you could innovate. The most expensive kind of products to make are products that require molds to make them. And the bigger the mold, the higher the cost. For example, if you want to make a product that is, let's say, a suitcase, if you want to make a suitcase that is so big, maybe it's 3 feet big and another 2 feet wide or something, you could be talking about, you know, $50,000 just in mold cost. Whereas if you want to make a comb, like, you know, like a beard comb, you just want to make it in a different shape or different, you know, the mold cost for that is probably less than $1,000 to do that, plus other development costs. So I will put on the low end, $5,000. On the high end, it could be as much as, I've seen projects that cost as much as $250,000 before. And these are very big, or it has something to do with electronics. So when you're designing a new circuit, let's say you come up with a new Bluetooth speaker, you have to do circuit design, you have to do so many things. Those could run a little, you know, high. When you have to redesign a whole circuit board, or you have to make big molds to fit the circuits in. But if you're talking about soft goods, like in fashion, in towel, and all those little items, I would put it like maybe 5,000 maximum, 7,500 all in to design, to develop, to do prototypes and stuff like that.
Very good. I just realized Marsha Reese was on the panel now. Marsha is a absolute serial entrepreneur, and I will get to you in a second, Marsha. I know Rana and Briar and Shashashna has been waiting a little bit for a question. So let's start off with Rana.
Thanks, Norm. Thanks for having me on the panel today. Great to see everybody. I just wanted to go back to basics for a second. You know, we're talking about innovation, but, you know, this question is for the panel is, how do you actually define innovation, right? Like in my mind, I kind of equate innovation to a unique selling proposition or USP. But is innovation, is it in the design? Is it in a feature, function? Is it better results? Or it can be simply better branding, like both Norm and Paul have kind of mentioned that. You know, does branding count as innovation?
Well, I believe it's a little bit of all of them. I would talk from a structural perspective, the actual look and usability of the product. And then maybe Paul and Norman can talk from the branding side because that plays a big role. For example, when you're designing your packaging, if you're very clever and you're very innovative in your package design, you could one, save cost and also have a better appeal, like out of the box experiences with this product. But when I talk, I will talk more from the structural innovative angle, which is the look, the feel, and the usability of that product. If your product, other product doesn't do what your own idea does, then I would define that as innovative.
I mean, I agree with you, Afolabi. I think it's everything. I think of brands like, a friend of mine owns a brand called Tushy, and it's a bidets. They're called Tushy Bidets. So I think they're, make sure if you're going to do a search, it's hellotushy.com. The other one is a fairly graphic adult themed website, just FYI. But it's, if you look at her branding, like her marketing around a toilet seat bidet. Now, toilet seat bidets have been around for decades. I mean, they're huge in Asian markets, specifically Japan, Korea. They, you know, started making their way over to the States in the mid 2000s. Actually, one of my clients back when I was a marketing consultant was bidetsplus.com, and they sold thousands of dollars of bidets every single day. Anyway, all to say, the bidet is not a unique product. A bidet attachment is not a unique product either. But what Mickey has done is she's just really, 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 really good at branding and marketing. And so she's taken a thing that has, there's already demand for it. There's already, you know, stuff out there. And she's just done a better job of marketing it. Now she has made a lower cost version. And so there's other improvements that she's done. So I look at examples like that as saying like, her edge is branding and marketing. But then there's others that, you know, just they win across the board. So Rana, I would say everything. It just depends on like, where are you an expert at and the areas that you're not an expert. So let's maybe you're not an expert at actual product differentiation, like product tuning, making the product itself different. That's where, you know, people like Afolabi come in, or what's the other company in Austin? Norm, can't think of them off my head. Anyway, Gatita is the reimbursement one.
Gemba.
That's it. Gemba. Anyway, there are companies that help this. Suffice to say, and also like what Afolabi was saying too about packaging, he's spot on. For the first 4.5-5 years of our business, like I was pushing for packaging on our stuff, but I couldn't really make a strong case because that's a very brand first approach. There's, I mean, you could say that you can throw in some marketing calls to action and stuff and all that jazz. Like we didn't push forward on it because my wife had thought that it was going to cost us an arm and a leg. It ended up not costing us that much to do. And we're actually paying less for better packaging. We're able to ship it at a smaller standard. So we're able to ship it in the smaller standard size versus the large standard size, which saves us, I think last time I checked, it was 60-70 cents per unit. It's just massive amounts of savings. So like even there, we're improving the product experience via the brand, the packaging, right? Because it's about the first introduction to, you know, people seeing our product is that package experience. So I could go on, but I'm obviously going to lean really hard on the branding stuff because that's what I'm good at. And when I need to have, you know, better, more innovative products built, we go to our customers, ask them what they want, and then go back to our team that we have to develop them out.
I'd like to hear if Marcia or Steve have anything to say about this.
Thanks, Norm. Yes, I think that features are important. Giving your customer what they want is always the best product position from my point of view. I also think at this particular time, having something made in North America is resonating with my customer base. So I think features and benefits, listening to what your customers need and giving them a better mousetrap is a great way to drive a product success.
Hey, gang, the question as I understood it is, you know, where can innovation be applied? And, you know, to me, the answer is, you know, innovation is just coming up with a novel solution to, you know, some sort of problem. So whether it's a product problem or a branding positioning or, you know, where the product is made, any of that can have innovation. And, you know, at this point in the world, we are forced to innovate in many ways to survive, right? Freight is a nightmare. We have, you know, predatory competitors with all kinds of hijinks. And so in every possible way, you have to innovate operationally, financially, marketing, etc. So I don't think you go, well, you know, I've got one innovation dollar to spend. Where am I going to spend it? You really have to think about how you apply, you know, survival skills to every function of your business. And I'll tell you, you know, when it comes to, you know, kind of international global freight right now, it's out of control, right? And there are some very significant changes that have happened since, you know, before COVID-19. And those are expected to hang on for some time. Like I've seen predictions as much as 2 years, although easing slightly. So all of those things, whether it's packaging or how often you ship or the methodology you use to, you know, create your product to maybe lighten it up or make it a little smaller, better, whatever it is, innovation can be applied anywhere. So it's a very good time for the topic, but I think you can apply it anywhere.
I think, Norm, also I want to remind everyone that by coming on stage, you're agreeing to be recorded. So those of you who just spoke, if you don't want to be recorded, say so now. Otherwise, you've been recorded. And I wanted to add, you know, it definitely, you can innovate in all of these areas, as everyone said, and that becomes very clear when you think about why do we innovate? What's the purpose of innovation? And when you think about it, really the purpose of innovation is either to improve something's efficiency or to make something more productive or to gain a competitive advantage, you know, with it. And so all of those things or many of those things can be achieved from all the different areas we talked about, from branding and marketing to changes to the product development itself. So it's all contributing to those objectives.
All right. Well, Briar, you've been waiting to ask a question for some time. Welcome to the stage.
Thank you so much. So my name is Briar Dougherty, and I run a career development company called Career Organic. And I know we're talking about physical products right now, but I actually have a product that we developed as a course. I do a lot of teaching, a lot of webinars on career development. So like, you know, how to write your resume, how to transition your career, how to make a pivot, how to interview better, all of those things. And I saw this, you know, outpour in the community and global community that people wanted this information and wanted it at an affordable rate versus, you know, what we do on a one-on-one basis with clients. And so I packaged this into, you know, what is now an online course. And you know, have gone to market, I've done my testing, I've spent my money in key areas to really, you know, innovate the product. My innovation was, you know, creating actionable results. So everything like has a to-do and a why you're doing it on top of like an online community to support questions. So you're not just left alone. But when we went to market with it, while I get tons that like people will sign up for a $99, you know, boot camp with me because it's, you know, me speaking live, it's been hard to convert the product itself. So like, hey, we now have kind of my brain in this productized, you know, scalable, you know, format. And I'm wondering, you know, when you think about innovation, it's like we've talked about the branding side, we've talked about the product itself. And I feel like the product is there, but maybe the branding isn't. And I'm wondering, you know, if, and I'm throwing this out there for all of you, but is when you're looking at that, you've done your testing, you get great reviews, like I was the humble leader saying, hey, I know my idea is not going to be the end idea. And so we've made changes. And whenever someone uses it, we get great reviews. Now it's translating that to the market for a need that is, as we all know, COVID took tons and tons of jobs. So the need is out there. So I've got the niche market identified and we're out there. What would, you know, any opinion on if we were going to spend more money on trying to get more conversions in the market, where would you focus on first, or how would I do better testing? Does that question make sense?
Let's put it out there to the panel.
So I want to be clear. Are you looking at what KPIs you should measure against?
No, it's so I've been looking at, you know, my key performance indicators are really, you know, we have great reviews. So like satisfactory, you know, reviews and user experience is there. So I already, like, I've accomplished that. Then we've repackaged kind of how we do our branding. So it looks like an actual product you could buy, right? And that's gotten really good reviews. It's that translating to the market, you know, what we need to kind of bring to them to say, hey, they need to buy this, has been kind of a difficult realization over the past year and a half, because people want this product. It's the making them realize they need it.
Have you talked to your successful students or people that have gone through it and gone, like done a survey with them and just saying like, hey, what are the things, like, why did you purchase? What are the things that you've gotten out of? Have you done any of that?
I have. Most of them come back saying they saw me speak. So they saw me live somewhere first, and then that's what converted them. But it has not been from our marketing.
I would ask a deeper question then too about, like, what was it specifically, you know, me see, like, what was it that I said that resonated with you?
Okay. Okay. No, I like that. Thank you.
And Colin, I saw you on mute, but those are what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I actually, it's funny you said about speaking. I was just before you said that, I was thinking, wow, this could be a great opportunity for Clubhouse, for you to use Clubhouse, find the right rooms, find the right channels, the right clubs, really connect in those clubs, become an expert in your space, and then bring people along. There's a lot of models on Clubhouse that use the sort of masterclass technique, and it seems like Clubhouse might be one of your answers here.
Awesome. No, I like that idea. Yeah, getting used to this platform, so.
Oh, I'm sorry, Paul. One quick note. Is, you know, you it sounds like you have a mechanical issue there. It's either the offer or it's the communication of the offer. Assuming that you're getting enough traffic to the offer and you're not getting enough conversion, then you need to tweak the offer. That's either, you know, price or the copy and, you know, the offer itself. If you're getting not enough traffic, then, you know, that's a top of the funnel problem. You got to figure out.
Right. And the traffic has definitely been there. We've run ads, we've done test ads, and we get tons of people to the conversion page, and then it doesn't convert. And then I can do a webinar and tell people about it, and afterwards I can convert it with the same copy. So we've changed the copy quite a few times. So is it really just a, like, play the game and until it sticks? Would that be the recommendation for the most part, like from a branding perspective?
I mean, there's, I'll let Steve, I have a couple thoughts, but since you asked Steve, I will, but I have a couple thoughts.
Well, the one thing, and again, you know, digital products are, you know, kind of a specific kind of field. And there's the well-known digital marketing customer journey, right? To get them to commit to some sort of micro transaction along the way. And after they've done that once or twice, it's, they've seen you enough, they have that familiarity, they're willing to make that jump. But it's very clear, if they're not willing to, you know, read what you have and deal with whatever that journey is thus far, then you haven't taken them far enough. There's something missing. And so, you know, I think Paul's advice is good. Find out what's resonating with the customers. Make sure that's on the page. Maybe you should be driving them to a webinar and then you push them to convert. Maybe there's a microtransaction or two ahead of time, but I would definitely look up the digital marketer's customer journey template, because that applies specifically to online courses.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's what everything that Steve said was what I was thinking through. Is it sounds like there's a disconnect. If they're falling off, you got good traffic, then you may be skipping a couple steps in terms of relationship building and going for the sale too quickly. So that I would look at that. I would look at if you have any welcome mat. I like to call them welcome mat offers. I don't like calling them tripwires because I don't want to kill my customers. Tripwire is something that explodes. So I prefer welcome mat offers. So maybe think of like other welcome mat offers that you could do. But I'll kick it back over to Norm because I know that we're running close on time.
Yep. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So we are going to cut it off at 2 Eastern. I know that we have Shoshana has a question. She's been waiting a long time. Welcome to the stage, Shoshana.
Hi. I do have a question in regards to, a little bit earlier, you guys were talking about patents. So I just wanted to ask if can we do international patents? That way we don't have to go country by country for the patents of the product. And my second question is regarding the manufacturing. So if we select a product and we want to manufacture it, I don't know if you guys could suggest some options which we can choose for manufacturing. Thank you.
Yes, there is an international patent, but it's very, very pricey. And what they do is, so there are countries that the U.S. has treaties with, whereby when you do a patent in one, in the U.S., these other countries respect it because they have a treaty among each other. I really don't think China is part of that treaty. That's why it's necessary to do it also in China. I do know many European countries have treaties with the U.S. I'm guessing that's why Amazon would accept your European trademarks here in the U.S. as valid, because there is an internal treaty, among those countries. But I don't think, I know Trump tried to, when he was in office, he tried to kind of smoothen that part out with China, but I don't think it was ever got done while he was still in office. So for manufacturing, can you help me clarify more what you mean by what manufacturing you should go for?
Consider clothing, like a specific kind of clothing or a jacket or something like that, or a jewelry.
Yeah. Okay. So the world has changed a lot, honestly. And I think Marcia mentioned that made in the U.S. is resonating more with our customers. And I believe, yes, that's where the trend is going. China is not the only place you could make stuff. India is good. Pakistan is good. Vietnam is rising star. In many of these, there are many of these countries that are kind of really developing very fast, and they're very manufacturing friendly. In garment, at the moment, I know China is still leading, but I do see top contenders like Gap and Old Navy. They're really going to, even they're going as far as African countries now, like Egypt, Algeria, and some other places to make their clothing now. Nike is making most of its clothing in Vietnam now. So there are so many choices. The easiest might be China at the moment, but if you don't want to go the China route because of the lessons we've all learned last year about relying overly on China, then you might want to take a look at other countries. I will check out Vietnam.
I want to pop in here really quick. I'm not anywhere as much of an expert as you, Alpha Lobby, but we found good value in going to the Sourcing at Magic show. mm-hmm. in Las Vegas. And that's a good event that I think they're doing it live again this year in August. They did it virtually last year. And the cool thing about this event, Tashana, is that they actually organize the trade floor based on country. And so they'll have like a whole section for the United States. They have, we found a garment and apparel cut and finish manufacturer in Colombia. And one of the benefits of Colombia is its central time zone. Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry about, you know, having to stay up in the middle of night to talk to China or anywhere in Asia. That's duty free. So we don't have to, we don't have to worry about paying taxes or anything that we get. So it is a little bit higher cost, but I would say sourcing at Magic. And I know that we're about to close, so I'll end.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that what we found, because 90% of textiles come from China, is that China has been the best solution for our companies. We tried to look at Vietnam and South Korea. And the reason why China is leading here is because they basically control the cloth market. So when you go to Vietnam, you have to ship a lot of it from China to Vietnam, and then you manufacture in Vietnam. It can increase the time to market for some of your products. But I would say the most important thing here is actually not the country, but your relationship with the supplier, whether Vietnam, China, or Hong Kong, South Korea, the supplier.
That's very true, Colin. China has cornered the fabric market. Even some people that are making clothes in Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, they still have to ship the fabric from China all the way to those countries because China really have cornered the fabric market. You're very right, sir.
All right. So I think that's it for today. I appreciate everybody listening in. And if you get a chance, please follow our experts. The information that they gave today are fantastic. They're very knowledgeable. And I'm not used to doing this. Paul Barron's usually the one doing all the closing. But if you get a chance, like I said at the beginning, we're doing something completely different. We're bringing in guests and taking one topic from my podcast, Lunch with Norm, that we're doing each week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and just going further than what the podcast does. So this time we're talking with Afolabi, and we'll be doing this every Thursday at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. So thank you everybody for joining us.
Real quick, can I promo the Prosper? Yep.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yep, so I'm gonna be speaking at Prosper, which is one of the biggest, if not the biggest show for Amazon sellers and e-commerce providers this July the 13th, 14th, 15th, I think it is. It's in Las Vegas. It's live, and I'm fairly positive they're also going to have a virtual event. And if you want to get a discount and you want to go, you can use my code. It's SPK17, so like speaker 17. So SPK17, and then you get $100 off your ticket for Prosper. So if you want to go, that'd be great. I'm going to be there. We're going to be trying to organize some meetups beforehand too, so it'll be a lot of fun.
All right. And on that note, thank you, everybody. Thank you for being part of this community. And we'll see you next Thursday.
Thank you so much, Norm.
Thanks, Norm.